Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. I'm the second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where family B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Chris Bingaman, third generation and CEO of Bingaman Lumber. Founded more than 80 years ago in central Pennsylvania, Bingaman Lumber has grown into a highly respected manufacturer and supplier of hardwood products, serving customers across a variety of industries while maintaining a strong commitment to quality, sustainability, and responsible forestry. Chris represents the third generation of family leadership, but what makes his story especially interesting is his willingness to challenge some of the assumptions that often exist in family businesses. Rather than simply moving family business members into leadership roles, he and his family made the decision to bring in a non-family president to help lead the company, creating a different model for succession and long-term stewardship. That decision, along with the broader questions of leadership transition, family dynamics, technology, and the future of manufacturing, makes Chris uniquely qualified to discuss what succession planning looks like in practice, not just in theory. Chris, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Yeah, well, great to be with you. Looking forward to this discussion.
Same here. So for any of our listeners who are not intimately familiar with Bingaman Lumber, could you tell us in your own words what the company is all about and what role it plays in the marketplace today?
Yeah, most of those people, when I tell them we have a lumber yard, they think of 2x4s, building materials, or plywood. That's not us. We are the manufacturers of hardwood lumber. And so what that means is we're located here in Pennsylvania, and over 70% of the forest, the state, is forested. And that's where we get our trees. We get we process trees and of a various different species, like window products like flooring, furniture, moldings, and a variation of other products. And interestingly, you know, we have probably 30% of our business is overseas. The hardwoods of Pennsylvania are very well respected, known around the world. And last year we shipped lumber to over 30 different countries. Wow. So that is all something that has been somewhat of a secret. A lot of people living in Pennsylvania wouldn't appreciate what we have here as far as a resource.
That's awesome. And recently I happened to be visiting Mystic, Connecticut, and touring some of the history where back in the day, a lot of shipbuilding was happening in Mystic, and it was all hardwood, and they still maintain some of the, you know, the legacy work. But one of the shipbuilders that was there kind of doing a demo said, you know, there's certain varieties of wood that are, he's like, you just can't get them. I mean, or you can't get them easily, or you have to be very careful with how you get them. It made me appreciate the delicate balance of, you know, responsible forestry, really. And I guess your crew lives that every day, right? I mean,
yeah, it really is. And you know, what's surprising, Ed, is the forest really, and this is not true just for Pennsylvania, but the U.S. Forest Service does kind of the hardwood resources pretty much east of the Mississippi River, but it's growing 4 times faster than we are cutting it. And part of that's because the industry has been in contraction, a lot of substitutes for wood. Our industry is, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point, changed dramatically in the last 20 years. It's a third the size that it was 20 years ago overall as an industry. So that's been one of the challenges for us, but also it's meant that there's less opportunity for the resource to be utilized.
Understood. So yeah. Getting back to your role as third generation family leadership, when you look back, Chris, you know, what are some of the great lessons that you learned from the generations that came before you? I don't know if you had exposure to Gen 1 or just Gen 2, but talk a little bit about the exposure you had and what the takeaways were.
Yeah, and I'm really blessed from that because I did have exposure to Gen 1. I knew my grandfather very well. He passed away when I was 11, but believe it or not, I have so many wonderful memories of him. And as part of it is because he was a an entrepreneur. He had cattle. He had this lumber business, and my dad eventually joined. He had a general store, and we lived in a kind of an apartment above where he lived there at the store. So I was with him all the time and got to know him. And then, of course, it was really hard for me when he passed away. But he and my father, I think the thing that I would just say about, I have been so blessed to have two role models of integrity. There's never been a question about if we owed somebody money or we've got something extra, we would turn it back. My father was all about integrity. And I think the other thing that I'll never forget, the piece of advice my dad gave me when I first got out of college and came into the business, there was things I didn't know, and he started to get me involved in buying and sales. And so I'd be talking to people, and he said, "Chris," he said, "whatever you do, if you hear a term or you don't know something, don't act like you do. Pause and ask. Be willing to find out." And Ed, I'll tell you how well that served me. What I found is when I would talk to people that were in the industry, our industry for a long time, and they'd use a term, and I'd say, "Hey, I don't know what that means." It was incredible how much time they would take to show an inch because I showed an interest and explain it to me, or hey, tell me, did you think about this or do that? And some of the best advice I got was because my dad had told me, be open about what you don't know.
And that's especially, I think, a valuable takeaway for any of our listeners that are on the early end of their career. I think there's a tendency to kind of nod your head and pretend that the gibberish coming out of the other person's mouth makes sense to you when, as a young person, a lot of the vernacular and terminology in industry doesn't make sense. It certainly, probably didn't for you, Chris. It didn't for me when I first started. And having the wherewithal to ask, and I think you find more often than not that you've got a willing participant saying, "All right, let me teach you something. I'm good to go." And I think that's a great takeaway. Recently, you participated in a panel, and I was fortunate enough to be in the audience, called "Succession Planning in the Trenches." And so, I want to ask you, why do you think succession planning remains one of the most difficult challenges that a lot of family businesses face?
I'm that's a great question, and I'm new to that because my father and grandfather, because of what happened between them, he did a lot of succession planning. So it was actually more recently, in the last 15 years, when I talked to people my age or my colleagues, and understanding, hey, so few people do that, and so I had to think, okay, why is that? But there's no question. Part of it is the fear. Part of you have to start talking about your own demise or your own exit, and that's not a comfortable conversation. But also, equally, I think that's really what I sense is it's complex. I mean, if you have a very most family businesses don't have maybe just one family member, they might have multiple family members. Well, how am I going to work that out? Or I have a family member but I also have other children. What am I going to do with that? And it's almost easier just to say they'll figure it out than to deal with it. And I think those aspects of facing your own mortality and your own exit and the complexity of it probably is for the people I've interviewed, that is the hindrance.
And sometimes it takes a wake-up call. And the wake-up call doesn't always have to be a health scare. I think sometimes it is, and sometimes hopefully it's not too late when it is. But I know for me, when I first started having the conversation, it was actually at my at a recent college reunion. And it wasn't just seeing everybody there, Chris. It was actually there was a board up on the wall for my class about the dear departed, and there were 20 individuals, and we're at a 30-year. So, and I'm standing there looking at it, and these are young men and women I knew who were gone. And I'm like, yeah, we're hitting that age where stuff happens. So, I kind of came back and said, okay, it's time. We need to lay down some plans. But had it not been for that experience, Chris, I don't know that I would have put that in motion. I think it's a good takeaway is that, don't wait, because if you wait and you hit when it's too late, you can't go back in time, so.
Well, that's right. I think the other thing, Ed, that I feel pretty strongly about is that if you've built something, have something that is valuable and other people's lives are depending on it, then be a steward of what you've been given. And part of that is thinking, how can I take this and hand it off? I'm caring for the other people and caring for family members. My dad, I mean, we'd have family meetings, and I have four sisters, and I had brother-in-law's in the business, but he definitely wanted the business to come to me. And that's another story in itself. I'm sure we'll touch on it, but he communicated that, and so he did a wonderful favor for me that. That as he exited the business, there was no question about, okay, what was going to happen? How was it going to unfold? And it was just a it was a gift to, I think, the organization, and a gift to me and our family.
That's great. And certainly sounds like and sadly you didn't have your grandpa around as much as I'm sure you would have liked, but nonetheless he imparted something on you, as did his son, as did your dad, it starts with strong and you it's clearly you bucked the trend, because a lot of people say it's the third gen that messes everything up. So
I heard that quite a
although Chris, honestly, I don't put a lot of stock in that, because by the time you get around to the third gen, I think third gens are wise to
bit.
that. They know. So I think you're especially more vigilant to make sure everything goes really well. So I think we're seeing a reversal of a that anecdotal trend. Another board, you serve on a board, a multi-generational family business. And you were telling me before this program that you were in the process of selecting the next president. And if I understand it correctly, there were several family members of this organization that were interested in the role, including one who wasn't currently involved in the business. And ultimately, that's the individual who was selected to lead the company. I thought that was a very interesting chain of events. And you don't have to name names or specifics, but talk for a moment about what did that experience teach you about su succession or objectivity and really choosing the right leader over the expected leader? Because that was a very interesting scenario.
Well, just to add a little bit to that, serving on that board has been a wonderful experience for me, and that experience in itself really was just valuable for me. And that was probably, I'm going to say, maybe 10 years ago, but it was a strong family, had a lot of family members in it. It was looking for the third generation, and they really came to the outside board. It was myself and three other outside members, and they said, "We really like you to select the next president, and we prefer it to be a family member." And in the meantime, they had also had some family business counseling, and that particular counselor really counseled us, "Hey, I don't think you have a family member ready. I think you should go outside. I think that's where the organization is headed." So we had two voices, speaking to us there. We knew the family desired this, and we knew this outside counselor was looking at it saying, "I don't think there's anyone that's ready." So we had four candidates, and the one thing I learned is what the value of profiling. Which I use heavily now here in our company, and that might sound, negative. It is not. It's just understanding somebody's strengths and weaknesses. And I knew some of the family members, three of them were already working in the business, so I knew them. When they got profiled, I couldn't believe how well the profile identified their strengths, their weaknesses, and helped understand how they were wired. And so that was a learning experience out of it. And you're right. We came down to the conclusion that we thought that if a family member who was not in the business was working for basically a public company outside the business had the skills. And we went back to the family, and our recommendation was is that we should bring him into the business. And we had a couple of projects that the company was involved with. We said, we think he should be given leadership in a couple of projects and see how he does, see how the family fits in and everything. And then we can determine and we can stage it and then ensure that that would be the right the right move. And it absolutely was. The company, I just will say this, he's probably been the president now for 8 years. He's doing marvelous. They've got a lot of family members, fourth generation family members that are in the business. It's a very unique company. And even the family members who were passed over for president are still working there, and they are fully supporting this guy.
Wow.
So it's a very unique success story, and one that I really admire in as their organization, and I learned a lot through the process.
That's awesome. So, speaking of profiling, were there any specific tools, or was it a collection of tools that you used in making doing the profile assessments? Was
Yeah,
it
it's a
like a
collection of
tool be?
tools. I think it really helps you understand the personality, what would be the environment where they would be the most comfortable, what their skills would be. I mean, it talks about, gives you their intellectual agility, helps you understand what would be the areas where they're going to need support, and areas of just also areas where just to be aware that this would be a weakness that they may not see. And yeah, it was very well done, and those profiles, and we have used them a lot. And I will say this, Ed, I think it's one of the gifts that we've been able to give emerging leaders in our company, because we started doing that, and I do these mentoring programs in our company, and anyone that goes through that program, I get them profiled, and then we actually go to the company that profiles them, and we spend a half a day talking about their profile, their particular profile, and how they engage with other people, and just watch people learn about themselves, understand themselves better, is a gift, you know.
Yeah, that's a great great resource, and also underscores the thoroughness by which you went through that process, on the board of that other family business. And I appreciate you sharing some detail, because it's not as though you just said, okay, here's the role, have at it. You said, let's, okay, we see how he profiles. We think he's the right guy. We feel good about it, but let's test him. Let's see how he does in the environment. Let's give him some hands-on opportunities to prove his worth in battle. And it sounds like he did, and perhaps won at least the respect of his of other family members involved. So there was no, hard feelings, or hey, I was passed over. But no, this person demonstrated.
He really did. He demonstrated his ability for analysis, and everybody has weaknesses, and we understood what his weaknesses were, and those also came up. But we were able, as a board, to be able to kind of help support that and tell the other leaders around him, you need to give him time here. We're working with that, and it just was a very, I mean, it was not without issues, always is. But when you have people that are open-minded and want the best for the organization, and that's the way this family was, for the most part, it went very well, and they're doing extremely well today.
Excellent, excellent. That's so good to hear. So when I was in the audience listening to you on the panel, you made a point, and it's funny. I was intrigued by it, because it never really occurred to me. But you talked very openly about recognizing the fear factor that a family member can experience when they're just considering joining the family business or potentially taking on the leadership role. In my case, I wanted it. I wanted to buy my dad out. I did it. The fear factor came after, because I'm like, okay, now I better not screw this up. That's when the fear stepped in, but certainly not about the taking it on, But if you can expand on that a little bit and how you've seen that, and maybe even, how that may have even showed up in your own family business.
Well, the one thing I didn't at that particular agenda, I didn't really get a chance to share this, but I went through that myself. There was a period of time, I don't know if I've mentioned that, but I went through a really serious cancer diagnosis when I was 34 years old.
My.
I was given a year and a half to live. I had a cancer called multiple myeloma, and by God's grace, I went through a bone marrow transplant from my sister, and it saved my life. And then so I'm early 40s now. I'm back in the business, and the business, went well while I was away and all that. And I'm thinking business is changing. I'm thinking, man, I started to have this fear factor, and it didn't. Honestly, it was. I've had to do a lot of apologizing to people in the organization later on because that fear made me more of a leader that had very short patience with the people that didn't perform, and just the period of growth I needed in my life and as a leader. But it was when I really got to the essence of why I was critical of everybody and putting hams down, and it was just because I was feared for myself that I was going to screw the family business up. And interestingly, as much as I went through that and figured out it myself, I had four daughters, and we're in a pretty male-dominated industry. And I just wanted the four da our four daughters to feel like if there was an entry into the business, or there'd be places for them in the business to use their skills if they'd ever want to come in. Obviously, not saying you're going to be president someday, that could happen, but and so always tried to let them know what was going on, bring them here. They worked here. Someone worked here during the summer. Just did whatever I could to encourage them to keep thinking about the family business. It wasn't until I actually got a family business group from the outside to interview my daughters because I wanted somebody from the outside that they could talk to and communicate with about this, that it came up to say, well, I'd sooner go somewhere else and do my own thing, then the fear would be is that I would come in and maybe disappoint my grandpa or my dad, or the business would fail, or I wouldn't live up to what they thought. And that whole aspect just was a factor that they w was part of their decision. And it made sense to me.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And as you're talking, I'm thinking too, I also consulted an independent group from the outside as my dad and I were going through the transition. And they were very, very helpful. I think sometimes having that third party, helps because they can be somewhat unbiased. It pulls any of the emotional aspects out of the equation. And they can exercise good outside visibility and judgment and help navigate those. So, yeah, there's definitely a time and a place to bring some outside voices in to say, all right, help us get there, wherever there might be.
That, by the way, and I've used that outside party. Now I have son-in-laws. And to stay engaged with the family, because just to say, and what I've found is he's been able to help them even in their own careers, even though it hasn't maybe been in our business. So I really have appreciated the fact that he got to know them, and got to know them as they got married, and were able to continue to keep play that role as being an advocate for them.
That's awesome. That's great. Bringing it back to Bingaman for a minute, you made the decision to bring in a non-family president and transition yourself to the CEO role. So walk us through that, through your own business, where you said, okay, I'm bringing in somebody, they're not family, but this is the path we're going to take and how you came to that.
Well, I think part of it was as we went through the process we just discussed with my daughters, and all along we kept saying, hey, that doesn't mean they're going to be president, but we were saying, is there somewhere, what should we be looking? Do we groom them? How do we go about this? And in the meantime, I'm looking and saying, with their age and the gap and where I'm at, I'm thinking we need something, in between interim. And so our CFO really demonstrated a lot of the characteristics that I thought the next president needed to have, a better skill set, a different skill set than I had. And yet I know many times many businesses, the CFO is it seems like the next person is going to be the president. And there's a lot of warnings about that, right? Hey, I don't think that's the right decision for your business. But it was really helpful. We have an advisory board, Ed, that we started back in 2006. It's just been wonderful. And so I was able to take the advisory board and say, hey, here's what I'm thinking. They have observed him for 6, 8 years. And Scott is our current president now. He's been here for 20 years here. And we just were able to let them observe him. And the advice they gave me, he said, hey, give him some presidential tasks. So I'd give him some stuff for strategic plan. I gave him some stuff for cost setting. And he just really developed and shined in that. And so having the advisory board support this transition really was helpful in the aspect of feeling like it wasn't just my, I was what I was seeing, but what they were, someone from the outside and knew as well was seeing as well. So that gave me great confidence when we made the call.
That's cool. That's great. And so, I've seen that before. We've covered that a bit on the show. We've sometimes covered the person that is in the role of the non-family member coming in as president or CEO. And, sometimes I think there's a perception that bringing in an outside leader can feel risky, So, talk about as you went through that process, were there any concerns that you had, or maybe that your advisory board had about moving in that direction? Were there any people that were, pointing out potential blind spots or areas of concern as you were starting to move down that path?
Yeah, there were, but both of the advisory board and even I have some peers in our company that are my age, and would, in fact, one of them is retired, and one will be retiring this year. That as time went on, I could confidentially talk to them, and they have evidenced some concerns. Well, I think in this area, in that area, and none of them were game, were showstoppers, but things that we just said, okay. If he does become the president, this is where we're going to make sure he gets some either some outside intervention or some support. But what the main thing that I realized, Ed, was our business, and I guess every business, it's changing all the time. And he had a skill set that I really believe the next president needed to have. And while he was a CFO, more than that, he was great with analysis. I mean, when we hired him, we thought we kind of needed someone that was going to be a CFO in terms of accountant. But when he turned out to be, he turned me a lot more in costing and analysis, and the information he was able to gather and help make make business decisions and look at information and systems and say, here's what we need to do to make sure that's profitable and all that. That's what I saw in him, and that's the kind of precision. In analysis, I did things pretty sloppily because there was margin. It's not that anymore. And so that's what I saw in him and his ability to do that. And then, I mean, the most important point, I guess I didn't mention, is he fully aligned with our values. That was critical. That's where it starts. So that was not the issue. Once we knew that, he's been here long enough to know he fully aligned that way. It's more a matter did he have the skill set to take to the next generation or in the business.
That's cool. And I think it was advantageous that he had already been operating in the business for some
Oh,
time.
very
So
much
it
so.
was, you had the opportunity to see, the good, the bad, and the ugly in all sides of the individual and come at it with a more informed lens. Now that you're several years in, what's been most surprising about having this gentleman, a non-family president, run the day-to-day?
That's a good question. Probably how well it's going.
Okay.
I mean,
That's good.
I will say that. There was the when I first announced it. There was this transition, and we kept thinking, okay, what does that look like? And I meant that means you'll be running these meetings now, not me. And has there been bleed over? Has there been areas where I've meddled where I shouldn't have? Certainly. But we talk about them, and the board will help us to, decide some of that. And it's just, I think I said to you at one point that, he must increase, I must decrease. And it's really true. And part of that is visibility, but also part of that is where people know he's the go-to person. And I got to tell you this, probably, I don't know what it was, 6 months ago, I'm in one of our leadership meetings, and we're talking about Scott traveling, this is our president, traveling to one of our other locations. We have five locations in Pennsylvania, traveling one of the locations, and our HR director said, well, I'm really looking forward to traveling with Scott because I want some of that face time with him. Well, that's the kind of thing that used to ask for face time with me. And so part of me thought, oh, it's like that Scott's the guy. But you know what? The more I thought of that, that's exactly what I want. Where now the things that people have, they need some direction, they want some face time with him, that's the right move.
Now as CEO, how has I mean have was it hard, first of all, to give up those reins, or did you find that the transition it was easy to continue to let Scott take it on as you move through the transition? Did you find in yourself that it was hard, or did you find that the process was comfortable?
It was comfortable. I mean,
Okay.
but part of it is I had already, I think I was probably 66 when it happened or 65. But so there were things already the day to day that they were doing, other people were doing. Some of the transitions that I had planned for leaders who were leaving or my age were already in place. So there was already some of that was taking place. And Scott knew this for we I think I'm not sure, probably at least a year and a half, that he knew, hey, this is the one other role we have for you with the advisory board. We talked about it, let him know. So it wasn't like when it actually happened that there already wasn't some things that already have occurred. It just has been more of a natural thing that's going on, very comfortable in the way that
Excellent.
it worked.
Excellent. That's great. That's great. So, bring it back to the company. You've established a reputation for balancing environmental stewardship, manufacturing excellence, and long-term thinking. Talk about how you balance honoring that traditional craftsmanship that industry is known for, while continuing to be innovative and continuing to innovate.
Well, one thing I think is important in that equation, Ed, that I don't think I mentioned it before, is one of the I guess I would say the values that I got from my grandfather, and particularly my father, was how he valued people. And we are my dad always would say the most important resource we have is the people we have, and I couldn't agree with that more. So when we were going through the process of my ownership and what to do and all that, pretty early on, was a decision made that since we didn't have a clear succession for actually buying the business, that we would consider an ESOP. So we sold over a period of time, and we did this over probably about a 10-year period between some of my dad's ownership. I had an uncle that had some ownership. So in my ownership, the employees own 35% of their company now. So we're partial ESOP. Now, how that fits in with your question is this, that those people who, that craftsmanship and all the things that they did that helped us build that, the people side of being able to adapt to the new marketplace, and there is an absolutely new marketplace for lumber. Like I said, we've been in contraction. So we've had to remake ourselves. We have had to change about just instead of just doing lumber, now we've added new parts made of wood. We've had to do all kinds of processes with wood. And we have become a little bit more of, I would call it a boutique shop for wood than, like we used to be, where we were shipping full truckloads of one item to big manufacturers. So that could not have happened. That innovation could not have happened had it not been we had an engaged workforce. And it's one of the reasons that despite the industry being in contraction, we've been able to maintain the market share, at least we've been able to grow market share and maintain what we have been doing, especially over the last 5 years.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And as you're talking, I'm thinking, you most certainly had to make some big bets on supporting that technology with investments in equipment. And I have to think, without knowing your industry intimately well, that the equipment that you tend to buy is not small
Well,
equipment.
you hit the nail on the head. Everything we do is so expensive, and then we have money in standing trees. We have money in lumber being in process. I mean, it takes so much money in this business. And we back in 2021, we made a decision to really do the biggest capital invest we've ever made in our lives. I mean, by double we've ever made in our lives. And but part of it had to do with an AI component that where it processed lumber and mechanically and took labor out of it. And we put money on it down in 2021, and we did not install it till 2025. So just last year. But man, it has been a wonderful thing. It's working well. We have such a wonderful group two guys who did all the legwork on it for 3 or 4 years, and their prep work and what they did and their vision to make this machine run is just been we've just paid off so quickly that we have it up and operational now. And it's nerve-wracking from the debt. We've got more debt than we've ever had, which really bothers my dad, who's 90 years old, still talks about, what are you thinking, Chris? But it is the really some of the kind of things that we've had to do or believe are necessary in that investment side to be successful in the future.
That's awesome. And just talking with my own small leadership team, today we were talking about, there's where we are now, and we're well positioned because of the work we did 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And it takes about 2 to 3 years, for the industry to catch up. And I said, all right, gang, let's start thinking 3 years out from now. Where do we have to be?
Yeah.
Because we got to start working on that now so that we're
Yeah.
ready then. And it sounds like, you made a big bet on tech. Now, you mentioned there was an AI component to that, and that's obviously been entering every conversation. Certainly here, we're quite immersed. The new tech you brought, so that's got an AI component as part of that solution. Can you expand on that a bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a it's a lumber grading is actually a mathematical equation, and there's a
Okay.
National Hardwood Lumber Association. It tells how lumber's to be graded, and we did that manually. So we'd train men and women to grade, and they'd be on every board. They'd look at it, and then they'd apply that equation, decide the grade of that lumber, and then that would determine. And then we obviously over time, then you come up with all these proprietary grades. Customer will say, "I want that, but not that in that grade," and I don't know how many years ago, 6 or 8 years ago, a company up in Canada started to say they did it in the softwood industry, and then they started to tackle the hardwood industry and say, "We want to do defect recognition, apply that equation through cameras and through all the aspects." I guess the AI portion would probably be more a matter of how it can be individualized for different species or different companies. And we watched this as this technology emerged, and we put money down on 2021. We knew they weren't there yet, but they said, by the time you guys install it, we'll be there. And they were great. But like I was telling you, we had two people that Scott Schaefer and Tyler Shields, they drove this program, and those two guys did so much legwork that even with when the AI component to get them information, here's what we want, followed it and got information and that. By the time we implemented it, the implementation went much better than I anticipated that it would. So, yeah.
So, as you look at AI broadly, where and how, maybe in your industry, we talked about a scenario, but do you see it creating either opportunities or challenges in the greater manufacturing space today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll tell you, we have our second quarter board meeting next week, and that's on the agenda for the board. Okay, what are some ways that these other guys, the other people on our board, are implementing AI, how they see it being utilized? I think that each company kind of has to figure that out a bit on their own. And when I say it that way is because, depending how big you are, how small you are, where that fits. But also, I know for us, I mean, we've got to be thoughtful about, okay, the capital it's going to take, and what will be the payback on that, and is that the right thing to do, and how long if we wait a little longer will there be more development? So there's a lot of components to it, and I think that while we're hearing so much about it, I think every company is going to have to try to go through that themselves. And I serve on the board for four other companies, and it's the same discussion we're having at our board meeting. And it's been interesting, Ed, for me to watch because they'll assign one person who's in charge of AI and to figure out where they're another company I know has a task force, an AI task force at all different levels. And I think every company is trying to figure out exactly what we should do with this. They don't want to just ignore it. But how do we go about figuring out how to implement it? And I think it's probably one of the things each company has to kind of figure out on their own, depending on their size and what they have as personnel to do it.
True, true. And I think it's really interesting to hear you talk about Bingaman's implementation because, as I think back onto guests on this program, there's varying degrees of, I'll call it AI awareness and expertise or familiarity. I've noticed that it's growing with every episode I do. But I can honestly say there's only a handful in the manufacturing space that are truly integrating it into process. You being one of them, that a few other guests have referenced true integration. So that's I think certainly you were ahead of the curve when you needed to be, and now you're landing in a good place where I'm sure it's going to represent a competitive advantage for Bingaman. As I was preparing for our discussion, something stood out in that it seems that as a company, you do a very thoughtful job of telling your story through social media. It seems like you're fairly visible at trade events as well as industry engagement. So, Chris, you can talk about that for a minute. How important has communication of the story and kind of the telling and retelling of the Bingaman Lumber story been in terms of attracting customers, employees, and maybe even future talent and leaders?
Well, honestly, that's where I've really transferred a lot of that decision making to people that are here that are more immersed in the culture and know what works. And I'll just start off with advertising. I mean, we used to do print ad, and all of a sudden, we realized, hey, this it's that's not capturing our audience, and this help people make decisions anymore. And so, I found, frankly, found some of the youngest people we have in our sales group and said, okay, what should we be doing? And they work. There's where we rely a lot on our basically our ad partners, media partners to really help us with that and try different things. But on the social media side, we have a person here that she does a great job with just posting, letting things know. And there's no question. I mean, we see it, whether it's, whether it's first off with things we find in the community, people that come to us through the community for different things, or also, I mean, in the product, people will contact our salespeople and say, I saw this on social media. But the other part of it is just even getting employees. They follow that, other people looking for careers. And so, we post something about a job availability or whatever, and it's surprising how somebody be on social media that came up. So it's just a whole new means of being able to communicate. That's really, I think, important utilization of is every way we can.
And I'd have to say that based on what I saw, without knowing everything around your brand position and how you're looking to articulate, there was definitely just an air of authenticity in the messaging and a level of quality and professionalism that I think you were trying to drive that definitely was showing up. So, it certainly resonated, and enough so to ask
Well,
the
thank you. Thank
question.
you. That's a very nice of you to affirm that. And I totally give that credit to the people that are here because, besides just the messaging, we want it to be authentic and we do not want to present ourselves as something that we're not,
And that definitely came through. So I'm going to ask a big question and then a bigger question. So the big question is, if you look out 5 years from now, where do you hope Bingaman Lumber will be? What would be some things you'd like to see at the business? What's happening in the business to say, hey, we're on a great track here and a 5-year outlook?
I would really 5 years from now, I really would hope that that there'll be a continued development of the things that we're doing right now, and it will be immersed in the I would say the worldwide market, kind of like we are, but in a successful way that we are making products that really are have really created partnerships with customers. And what I mean by that is I think that's the biggest thing that we've tried to do is find out, okay, what is you're making? What are the problems in your raw material supply for that? And what can we do to find a solution? I'm hoping that we'll continue to be able to find more and more of those partnerships. That's been the strength that has kept us, carried us in the last 5 years, I think. And I think that's going to be the future of for our industry. And so that's what I hope. I just would hope that 5 years from now, if I come in here, I'm understanding more programs that we're working and really tied strategically as a strategic partner with more customers.
Nice. And here's the bigger question. Looking 5 years out, where will Chris Bingaman be?
Well, honestly, Ed, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I never dreamed I'd live to be 68, so here I am. If Lord gives me life till I'm 73, 5 years from now, I would hope, I would like to be still coming into the business 4 days a week. That's kind of what I've been doing now, though. Part of that, he must increase, I must decrease. I'm doing 4 days a week. Just started that this year, but still, when I can come in and I have a lot of relationships in the business, customers and suppliers, that I can still play a role and enjoy, be here when they're here, make sure that we have the values are being held. They need some mentoring. I can still be doing some mentoring about what's important going forward and be the main cheerleader. I would love that, and be able to come in here and just watch the thing hum, and know that we got people doing what, being stewards of what we've been given, and being successful and creating jobs and supporting lives.
That's awesome. And so I actually had the pleasure of having my own brother who was an employee here and also had the pleasure of running family businesses and then eventually his own, which he exited very successfully. And he said, when you get the right people on board and you put them in the right roles, he says the business just kind of takes off on its own after a while, and then it's really, the CEO role becomes more about guiding, guiding that energy than the doing. And it sounds like that's kind of where, you're looking to be, is to really just guiding it and supporting it and giving it help when it needs it, but ultimately being a, more of a mentor and a coach than a player on the team. So,
That's right.
yeah,
That's right. No,
awesome.
that's it.
And I often would say, as a, I'm an oops baby. I'm the youngest by 10 years, so I often say I'm happy to be here. But hearing your story, Chris, and the scare that you had and the prognosis you had, I'm definitely happy that you're here, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
So
Well, I just feel it, during the time, I'll just elaborate on it just for a minute. I was 34 and had four daughters, and one who the oldest was 9, and the youngest was 6 months. So you can imagine the difficulty of thinking, okay, do I have a year and a half? They gave me a year and a half to 2 years to live, and I ended up going for treatment down in Arkansas, so I was away a lot. My wife was with me the whole time, but we just had a community of people that supported us. But and one of the gifts of that is birthdays were still celebrations. Getting old has its issues. I am watching my mom and dad, who are both 90, and see the struggles, and there's no panacea when it comes to getting older, I guess, but on the same hand, it does just change the equation of the way you look at life and look at birthdays and even your own mortality. And I think that might have been one of the drivers of me thinking all along of how can I make sure that we can sustain this? What's the best way to sustain it? How do we go about that process? And that's what kind of led us to where we are
Wow.
today.
Wonderful. Well, I feel like I could talk to you for hours, if not days, Chris, but I'm gonna hit you with the last question. If any of our listeners wanted to connect with you to learn more about you or learn more about Bingaman Lumber, what's the best way to do that?
Well, certainly, I think you're going to our website and they can connect with me through there. My email is just C for Chris, is C Bingaman at BingamanLumber.com. And I'm glad if someone would have any other questions or would like to, really discuss at all anything with estate planning or with their own transitions. It'd be an honor to do that because I know how much I've appreciated advice and people who took their time with me over the years and be glad to do that for someone else.
Wow, thank you so much. I appreciate that. So, just to wrap up now, what stands out most, Chris, is really the distinction between ownership and leadership. And many family businesses spend years discussing succession, but few are willing to sometimes make the difficult decisions required to position the business for long-term success, even when those decisions challenge the norms or traditional expectations, and even when they involve bringing in somebody that's not part of the family. So, Chris, your willingness to talk and think differently about leadership, stewardship, and the future of the company, you know, offer so many important lessons about really for family businesses of every size to consider and to dwell upon. So thank you so much for sharing your perspectives and your experiences and candidly sharing your own story and your own journey. Again, folks, we've been speaking with Chris Bingaman, third generation CEO of Bingaman Lumber, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. And this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.deleonet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeLeaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.